Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that always measures out the correct portion and goes, nah. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
In this episode, we discuss, should we nudge or should we shove? Should we affect change through small steps, or should we be boldly trying to change the environment in which we're living? What models should we be looking at to base good policy on? Turns out, Steve, Venezuela, not a good country to try and base a model policy on anymore.
I am shocked that this has become news.
Who could have predicted this 4 years ago?
I know, absolutely no one. No one could have possibly thought that Venezuela was going to struggle.
Maybe instead we could choose countries like Norway, like France, dare one even say it, Germany. So, Steve, the start of the podcast was about portion size, which is a reference to nudging. What is a nudge and what does it mean?
So, essentially, a nudge is a way of influencing someone's behaviour so that they take an action that you deem to be a positive. Continuing with food and portion sizes as the example, a nudge in this instance would be taking the labelling of something like, say, a cake, and then making it very clear exactly how many calories and how much sugar is contained in each serving, and also making it very clear what that serving looks like. Now, you may be thinking, well, hang on a minute, aren't all of those things already on the boxes for cakes and pretty much anything we eat? Yes, they are all there, but nudging is kind of taking that a little bit further. So it's rather than saying this contains X many grams of sugar, which is a bit of a nebulous concept, it's saying it contains this many teaspoons or this many tablespoons of sugar. If it's saying the portion size is or has this many calories in it, it makes it very clear what that portion size actually is.
So this cake serves 10 people or yeah. 8 people.
Yeah, and then so you are able to easily look at that and go, okay, I need to split that into tenths, and it looks like that. And then you've got a much better guide to make an informed decision about what you consume, what you eat, and what you choose.
Now, nudging is part of behavioural economics. So there are economists like Daniel Kahneman, economists like Richard Thaler, who've come out talking about behavioural economics and why it's a good thing. The plan was, back sometime in the 19th century, rather than talk about Theresa May's decision to call an early general election, we were going to do a podcast on behavioural economics as part of our season on personal responsibility. Why is nudging related to that area of personal responsibility?
Well, essentially, it's because it's an area where people still can make that choice for themselves. Let's say we have an aim, and this is something which has recently come out, so it actually makes this quite timely, in that we want to decrease the amount of calories being consumed by the average person in Britain. Now, there's been a report which basically said a lot of things that we're eating contain too many calories. There are two ways you can approach that. One is to, say, legislate and say a slice of pizza or a piece of cake can only contain X many calories, and then force the pizza manufacturers to then actually implement it. Or you would nudge people into just making healthier choices themselves by making it much clearer exactly what it is they're consuming. So again, with the pizza slice, it's kind of looking at it and kind of going, actually, that single slice of Domino's pizza contains 250 calories. I'm only supposed to have a maximum of 800 calories in this meal, therefore I should only have 4 slices of pizza. Okay, so I don't need to buy a medium, I need to buy a small.
Rather than, say, legislating, it's trying to give people the information so that you'll make choices yourself. I think what behavioural economists do, which is different, say, to other more free market economists, which have become the mainstream, is that they try and see people as not being, for want of a better way of putting it, wholly rational people, or people who all the time do the rational calculating thing. So Richard Thaler, in his book Misbehaving, talks about econs and humans, and the econ is that person very stereotypical of the free market thinker who always knows how to maximise pleasure or maximise gain perfectly every time. Instead, what behavioural economists, so people like David Kahneman and Amu Tversky found, Amos Tversky found, is that humans have, although usually are logical most of the time, there's certain cognitive biases that humans have. One of them is, they call the halo effect, which is more attractive people say are more likely to be believed than
people who are uglier.
People who look like us.
Yeah, the halo effect is with the notion that we are more likely to ascribe intelligence to people the better looking they are.
Things like the endowment effect as well. So it's this idea that people value more a possession they already hold more valuably than you would do if you were thinking rationally about it. I think you can see that in a lot of the Obamacare debate in the US, mm-hmm. where 4 or 5 years ago, Obamacare was passed and everyone said, well, it's not perfect. There's lots of flaws in the system. Whereas now it's trying to be taken away. People really want to hang on to that healthcare. Understandably, but it's an example of the endowment effect. People don't want some nebulous better thing further on. They want to keep the healthcare they already have. Behavioural economics and nudging has been used by the British government. So the nudge unit was set up by the Cameron government with the help of Richard Thaler. And one of the things that they looked at was how best to try and collect revenue for the government. So just by adding a sentence saying most people pay their taxes on time, by adding a small sentence to someone's tax return saying you are one of the small minority of people who have not paid their taxes correctly, means that revenue gets paid to the government quicker.
Mm-hmm. The reason being behind that is that it implies there's a social pressure to, in this instance, to actually conform to something, i.e. paying your taxes on time just like everybody else's. And that's what kind of nudging is about. It's about making those small little tweaks to things that will potentially drastically change somebody's behaviour. In many ways, it's actually quite similar to what David Railsford, who's the chief trainer for the British cycling team, calls marginal gains. It's about making kind of changes, little changes here and there, which over time eke out to bigger and bigger improvements.
Yeah, that kind of shift to data-driven analysis, which you're seeing especially in cycling, mm-hmm. Especially in cricket. Michael Lewis wrote the book Moneyball, which is about people who did it with American football. You're sort of seeing bits of it in football, but, and you'll be shocked to hear this, Steve, a lot of football is a little bit more resistant to the use of data and facts, as opposed to just going with pride and passion and your gut.
I am shocked and appalled by this. Half of that is true.
We've got nudging. I suppose the other thing is shoving. Now, we already talked about portion size. We already talked about how maybe we could try and combat obesity on a previous episode we did earlier in the year. If you subscribe to us on iTunes, listeners, you can find it in our past feed, along with all our very, very, very accurate general election predictions.
Yep, 100% accurate, not a single thing wrong.
About as accurate as the Home Office's student figures. Just a few weeks after that podcast was published, there was an article in The Guardian about Amsterdam and their strategy that a deputy mayor came up with to try and challenge child obesity, especially amongst children in poorer groups. So Amsterdam, just like Britain, it's a country with quite a lot of obesity, and obesity often is falls proportionately more on those from lower socioeconomic groups. And if you have a look at how Amsterdam are trying to combat obesity, they're not really doing nudging. If you look at some of the things that they're doing, so you've got some schools which are banning fruit juice, can only take in tap water to school, for instance. Some schools banning birthday feasts. So this idea that people come in with a cupcake for everyone on their birthday, and then other people come in with chocolates for everyone, that's banned. You've got to bring in healthy snacks. McDonald's has made agreements with schools saying that, in certain areas anyway, saying that a child without a parent can only buy fruit. So if you're under 16, I think, and you're going there to McDonald's on your own, you can't buy fries. You've got to only buy healthy food. Changing the school curriculum to try and make healthy versions of meals as well. So say putting broccoli on pizza or using leaner chicken rather than pork in your kebabs. Having a zero tolerance approach to sponsorship of sporting events. So there'll be no Burger King sponsoring sports festivals, no Monster Energy drinks sponsoring festivals. And also subsidising sports clubs and membership of any gyms and what have you for people from low-income families. So it's very much, it's not really a lot of nudging that's going on. There's a lot of what one could say top down, if you were a member of a certain right-wing publication, which neither of us aspire to, you could call it maybe the nanny state. However, it does seem to be working. Just in 3 years, from 2012 to 2015, the amount of children who are overweight or obese has fallen by 12%. What are your thoughts, Steve? When is it good to nudge? When is it good to shove?
Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, my response is that actually you probably do need to use an element of both. It doesn't surprise me that actually changing the context around around children has led to a decrease in childhood obesity over in the Netherlands. What you're seeing there is essentially just education in action. It's about making sure that people know what is healthy, they know what it is they should consume, they know what they should cut out more. And education, at the end of the day, tends to be the thing which enables people to be more personally responsible. Certainly there are elements around that which I think would be affect things around the margins, again, those marginal gains, such as the banning of fast food and energy drink sponsoring events and things like that. I, as a kid, would have been much less keen to go to McDonald's if I had to have carrot sticks compared to fries, but at the same time, as long as I'm getting that burger, I don't necessarily think I'd care that much. So I think there's elements amongst that stuff which is interesting and will probably make a difference around the kind of like the outlines of it all. But I think the main change you're going to see there is going to be around the education elements and making sure that kids know how to cook. Because if it's a case of the education curriculum is going and here's how you produce a healthy version of this meal, which is really popular and really nice, then you know what? That will obviously help.
Yeah, I suppose it's trying to get a mixture of having that education in schools, showing the right way, while not just assuming that if we set out the facts, then the facts will set us free.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that I think I might have been slightly dismissive of when what I just said then is around that kind of that lack of sponsorship of events. Because certainly, if you're a parent and you've got a kid and you've been working a full-time job and you've got to cook and things like that, and you're going out somewhere and they're seeing and they know that Burger King's a thing, well, they are much more likely to go, can we go to Burger King? Can we go to Burger King? Can we go to Burger King?
It's that environment where it's advertised everywhere. You've got famous people endorsing it. You've got them on sporting events and everywhere. You know, I think Coca-Cola is doing an initiative in various parks and what have you. So it's obvious that and as we talked about in the obesity episode, that pressure is going to come because of the environment and the society mm-hmm. we're in.
And I think this is actually probably where I think a lot of top-down or shoving policy changes tend to fail, is that they seem to... It's a single big change which doesn't tend to do that much necessarily about the environment as a whole. So again, going back to the UK with, say, the calorie consumption and the fact that we're saying, okay, we need to cut down on the calories in food now. The reality is, yeah, okay, we can legislate for it and they will legally have to decrease the amount of calories in the food, which will either mean using healthier ingredients, puts the cost up a little bit probably, but nothing too much, or making things smaller, or making the portion sizes smaller. The reality is, though, in either of those two incidents, given that the biggest cause probably of obesity is more that people don't know what an actual kind of portion size should look like. Like, again, I've started going through this and looking at what the portion sizes are that I'm supposed to be having for things. And I'm looking at them, I'm kind of going, you what? That is tiny, that's like half of what I would normally have had. But given that I'm overweight as a result, you know, it's clear that it is too much. But you just look at most of the food that we're served or that we serve ourselves, and if you go for just strict portion sizes, you look at your plate and you go, that's half empty. The main thing really is going to be educating people to know what should be on their plate and what size it should take, rather than just decreasing the amount of stuff. Because yeah, we might be able to decrease the amount of calories in a slice of pizza by 20%. That'd be brilliant. That's useful. That's helpful. But if I'm still sat there eating six slices when I only need to eat three, The actual gains are going to be minimal.
And it's about taking a more holistic approach and looking at the whole culture around it as well, because especially you look at obesity, we've talked about education as being a big issue. I mean, there's also the fact that the work and the nature of work is a massive factor as well. You're coming back after a full-time job. You might not have the time to cook and cook healthy, especially if you finish work at 10 at 5, it takes you an hour to get home at 6. But if you're going to cook for a couple of hours, you're eating at 8. Well, that's a long time that you're going to fill by eating crisps and chocolate and what have you, or just go to a takeaway because it would be quicker.
Yeah.
You've also got the fact that it does seem more expensive if you're in a low budget to try and buy fruit and veg, because it involves a certain amount of planning for different meals. So although
overall actually it is cheaper,
you need a bit of an action plan, don't you?
Yeah, you need an action plan. You need to have a notion about what you're going to have for your meal plan that week. And one of the things I've discovered over the past couple of weeks is my diet has basically fallen apart a little bit, because I have, like, what I was doing before was every like Saturday I was sitting down and going, what am I going to eat on each of these days, going through my recipe books, looking for things online and going, okay, I'm going to do this and this, and then I was relatively able to stick to it. You know, sometimes you can't stick to everything, sometimes things go out the window. Sometimes I discovered is that this thing says it actually makes enough for three, and in reality it only made enough for like two meals. So what I was actually counting on was an extra meal to take for lunch, and they didn't have that, so I was having to go to lunch at work elsewhere. But yeah, so because I've moved away from that plan, I've then ended up spending more money eating out and things like that. Now, partially that's just because I've been very busy over the past few weeks as well, but it certainly ended up costing me more, and I can see it in my bank balance compared to when I was actually eating at home a lot more.
And that's something, the eating out environment is something that either nudging or shoving hasn't really gone into yet. We eat a lot at Wetherspoons because we're normal blokes who go down for a pint and after a burger at Wetherspoons. It's how all the good ideas in this podcast get done. But they're one of the few places, I think, that actually put calorie counters on their meal. It's why it's the most depressing bit of going for a meal at Wetherspoons. Yeah. But at least the information's there. Whereas
you go to some of the other pubs, like there's one pub I go to right quite regularly, which is an Ember Inn. Again, it's a relatively big chain. It's well known as a chain. Their menu has like two things on there which have their calories listed. And those are the things that are basically under the diet section. So it's your chicken Caesar salad. It's a couple of other things like a skinny lasagna or something like that.
And when you think that more and more the way in which we're eating is changing, in that we are thinking that more and more people are eating out or getting takeaway, that is a big kind of uncounted calorie section. Maybe we should force Le Gaffe Rochon and all the Michelin star places as well to have calories on their meals. I think progressive social democratic solutions to things that take into account of the reality that we're in. Do you think in Britain you could have a local authority, say, taking the approach of Amsterdam?
Well, no, because they don't have those sorts of powers. But I think even if you did have those powers, let's say London did have that ability, which if there's anywhere that might have it, it would be London. If Sadiq Khan tried to put something like this in place, I think he'd struggle. I don't necessarily think we've not built the right kind of culture around this stuff yet. I think we're actually starting to get there, in that when you look at kind of consumption habits of the different age demographics, you'll find that the younger people are actually the more generally healthier they actually do eat. And again, this goes for other things like exercising, where just the other day there was a thing which came out which said of people aged something like 40 to 60, I can't remember the percent, but it was a shockingly high percent of people didn't even manage to get 10 minutes of exercise in a month.
It was like 6 million people, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So I think maybe 20, 30%.
Yeah, 20, 30% or something like that, which is insane given that I get 10 minutes exercise every week just walking down to the local corner shop to buy milk or, you know, to catch a bus. You know, even if I didn't do anything else, I would get that every day just from going to work. But I think what we've got here is that kind of difference in terms of age demographics, where you have this slightly older generation who are not as interested or for whatever reason haven't been as interested to date of this sort of stuff, they're going to be the ones also who are probably have the biggest spending power in these sorts of areas, and are going to be the ones that would probably need to kind of have their attitudes change in order to make businesses change.
Part of it, and maybe that can lead us on to the second bit of our talk, of our episode today, is looking to the continent and looking to Europe for policies and looking for policy solutions. Because I think the models often that a lot of our politicians look for in various countries often are from countries where you wouldn't really want to go and live yourself. Maybe it's a bit of an effect of Brexit, but it feels like one effect of the Brexit vote last year was to make us a little bit more aware of European politics. So it feels to me like there was more coverage of the French election this time, this year, than there was of the equivalent one 5 years before between Hollande and Sarkozy. It'd be interesting to see if the same is true with the German election as well, where it feels like they're still getting a little bit more coverage of Trump's antics on Twitter than the German election, but hopefully there'll be a lot of coverage of the German election too. Especially at a time when Venezuela, which is a place where a lot of people on the left, including our current Labour's current leader, have praised it. John McDonnell called Venezuela socialism in action. Owen Jones, who's one of the more vocal supporters of the Labour leadership in the media, have written articles in the past saying that socialism's critics look at Venezuela and say, "I told you so," but they're wrong. That's one area where the strongman Chavez has died, and now it's in a heck of a state, isn't it? Which is not, it's terrible for the people of Venezuela. It's also potentially going to be a major refugee crisis anytime soon. It's a bit of a failure of ideology, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the interesting things that you see with an awful lot of kind of like left-wing ideology is the places they turn to look for inspiration, rather than turning to the continent where actually through quite technocratic solutions or kind of technocratic bureaucracy, like for instance that Amsterdam example, they've been able to bring about some quite good results and decent change and make improvements across numerous areas. Rather than looking to the technocratic social democracy, they look for the something that appears to be more symbolic. The problem with symbolic ideology, though, is that often it then is the thing that falls down because it's built on a house of cards. It's built around that singular strong man. Or if it's not just built around that singular strong man, it's built on a very precarious economic position.
This is true on the right as well, I think, isn't it? If you look at countries like Singapore have been held up as bastions, as of places like Hong Kong. But Singapore is one of the few countries in the more developed world which has a higher rate of inequality than Britain. That's not somewhere that I would want to look for any policy solutions. The same is true of America as well, which I think, maybe because of its cultural soft power, is seen, I think, as both politicians of left and right. I know Crosland was quite praised America in the future of socialism back in the 50s. Lots of politicians in Britain see it take as a bit of a model. Tony Blair did as well, despite the fact that, as we say, America's also got quite high levels of inequality. Mm-hmm. It's not really somewhere I would want to go for ideal policy solutions.
No, I mean, I think that, as you say, there are elements of what you're talking about on the right as well, certainly with places like Singapore, in particular around there is like education. And I'm not a massive fan of the Singaporean education system, which is very much a learn it, recite it back, and then you have passed, rather than a more holistic approach that happens in, say, the Scandinavian countries. But I think there's one key difference is that between the left and the right on these sorts of issues is that the left holds up Cuba and Venezuela as being the alternative to where we are now. The right looks to Singapore for policy solutions. Those aren't the same things. This, you know, the outcomes may be bad in both ways, but Singapore, for lack of a better example here, hasn't resulted in the complete collapse of its economy and
people eating zoo animals.
Yeah. Maybe I'm not being entirely fair, given that Singapore is not a nice place to live. And I happily admit that. But the right doesn't hold up Singapore or indeed Hong Kong or, I don't know, even Saudi Arabia, which is also the one which has kind of been bandied about as a kind of an alternative, as a kind of a kind of but look over there thing from aspects of the left. It's gone, well, it doesn't, like if Corbyn's was friends with Maduro, fine, but look over there, Theresa May and the UK government have been chummy with Saudi Arabia. No one has ever said that Saudi Arabia is the way you should run a country. It's just one of those situations where, yes, we're chummy with them because they feed us an awful lot of anti-terrorist intelligence.
I suppose one of the things that you saw after Labour's manifesto, which a lot of people try to attack from the right for being very radical, and in response, rightly, Corbyn was able to say, well, this manifesto would still mean that we had a lower rate of corporate tax than, say, Germany. Nationalisation of the railways is also something that happens on the continent. Most of the major European countries have those railways nationalised in some way. So there was some acceptance of that is the normal in other countries. But it feels like we don't really look to continental Europe for our policy solutions, particularly.
No, and I think part of that's just because there is, I think certainly on the left, there's always been a romantic edge to the ideology, at least in certain segments of leftist thought, or left-wing thought, I should say. The notion of the revolution, the overthrowing of the current status quo, you know, building something new and better, is pretty integral to pretty much any string of left-wing thought. Granted, it's not a violent revolution necessarily. It's not, you know, destroying everything and then building it up again. Some of it is quite, and we shall reform, but we will reform heavily and technocratically. But it's still lead with a focus on change, 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 change. And I think the romantic edge of it all means that whenever there is something which looks like it's something new, it's something different, it's overthrowing the old system, it becomes very appealing to people to try and hop on that bandwagon. And I think that's what you've seen with places like Venezuela. I think to a certain extent that's what you've seen with Cuba, especially over the years. Given that its opposition to the United States as well, the United States' opposition to it, making it a very easy thing for anybody who was anti-US to hop on board that train.
I suppose with Cuba, maybe that's almost a bit like Singapore and its healthcare system, and its education system, because people say that Cuba's healthcare system is fantastic, which is probably true unless you disagree with the government, in which case...
Yeah, I mean, it may have a fantastic healthcare system, but it also bans unions. Which is not normally a sign of a progressive paradise.
As you say, it's this wanting to try and... Well, you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs. And not enough champagne, we are not romantics. We don't believe in revolutions. And we only believe in making eggs if you're actually making a literal omelette. And over what we're going to do over the next 2 or 3 months on the podcast is try and work out. Try and look to Europe. See what actually does work in terms of progressive solutions in all sorts of different areas. We'll be looking at health, we'll be looking at education, we'll be looking at trade.
Yeah, and we'll be hopefully looking at both the big kind of reforms as well as those small little nudges to bring it back to what we were talking about at the top of the podcast. You know, we're going to try and take a deep dive as much as we can onto these areas so that we can actually try and help start a bit of a conversation on what should the British left be doing.
So if you have any suggestions as to areas we could look at, if you have any suggestions as to contributors you'd like us to talk about, let us know on facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Let us know on Twitter. I'm at paperbackrioter.
I'm at Centre Radical.
Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper, and our logo was designed by James Cram. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. Happy plotting.